I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Amendment 1 on November's ballot is better known as Clean Missouri. Supporters of the measure claim it will create a more ethical environment in Jefferson City, while others attempted to block its placement on the ballot. Today we'll discuss the sweeping initiatives within the measure and how they could affect Missouri government and politics for decades to come. Then, for young couples just starting out together, financial decisions abound. Are there student loans left to pay off, rent a place, or buy? How to save money? Add children to the mix, and it can seem overwhelming. That's why the smart money experts are here with some strategies that could work for you. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The Clean Missouri initiative on the November ballot does a lot of things. It opens up legislative records. It requires politicians to wait 2 years before becoming lobbyists. It eliminates almost all gifts from lobbyists. And it does something else that a lot of Republicans has them seething. It makes dramatic changes in the way the state draws legislative boundaries. Why is that method so controversial? We're about to find out. With us, Deborah Leiter is a UMKC Assistant Professor of Political Science. Deborah, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you.
Jason Rosenbaum is a reporter for KWMU Public Radio over in St. Louis. Jason, welcome back. Always good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
And I should point out that I wrote a column for The Star on Thursday endorsing Clean Missouri as a game changer for the legislature. How big a change is this Clean Missouri package in total, Jason? What are you seeing with this thing?
I think some of the changes are more impactful than others. I think curtailing lobbyist gifts is a legitimate change. Frankly, I don't think the campaign finance aspects to this are terribly significant because it doesn't do a huge amount to rein in independent expenditures that are done by political action committees. And that's sort of by design since it has to be focused toward the General Assembly. I think both sides of the political aisle agree that the redistricting part is by far the most impactful. Currently, either a commission that's split evenly between Republicans and Democrats, or a panel of appellate judges draw state House and state Senate districts. I think that's been a contention for a long time among Democrats that they don't feel that the most recent maps gave them a fair shake, although the evidence that there was purposeful gerrymandering toward the Republican is fairly murky from my reporting. But I don't think there's any question that that's the most significant aspect of this. And I think how it actually comes about if this passes really depends on a whole bunch of things that I think we're going to talk about here.
Yeah. Deborah, how do you see this thing? How significant is Clean Missouri?
I think Jason hit it right on the head, is that most of the ethics reforms are fairly straightforward, either relatively minor changes such as campaign finance, which had already been dealt with in the previous election cycle. The lobbyist reforms are important. Certainly right now, Missouri is one of the few states without a clear cap on lobbyist gifts. But it is definitely redistricting that's getting the most attention and could have major effects on the political competition for the state legislative races.
You know, Jason, in the past, we've talked about Jeff City as the wild, wild west of loose ethics laws, maybe even in the country. Is this going to end that?
You know, I've never been of the opinion that laws are necessarily going to stop bad behavior in Jefferson City, because when people run for the state House and state Senate, or for statewide office for that matter, they don't go about to voters saying, I'm going to go to Jefferson City and I'm going to be tremendously unethical, or I'm going to cheat on my wife, or I'm going to take all this lobbyist largesse. And there's really no way for voters to peer into the mind and the subconscious of legislators and know for sure that they're going to engage in unethical behavior. Now, certainly there's the argument that the environment in Jefferson City encourages weak-minded people to do weak-minded things. If you're constantly being bombarded with free stuff from lobbyists, or you're able to raise a lot of money from a lot of different people, then of course that's going to change you as a person. But, you know, whether this actually brings different types of people to Jefferson City, I don't think is terribly clear. I think that the redistricting aspect will certainly change how districts are drawn. But I don't know if it really will change who ends up running for state house or state senate districts, especially since the amount of money that Missouri legislators are paid, which is around $37,000 a year, kind of blocks out people who are middle income because right. they can't really quit their job in order to run. It's usually very young people, very rich people, or retired people that typically fill these seats. So it's a verbose way to answer your question, and it may be a little too philosophical, but I tend to think that laws alone aren't going to stop bad behavior in Missouri.
You know, Deborah, my sense is that voters have long been ahead of the politicians in Missouri when it comes to interest in cleaning up ethics laws. You put something on the ballot that, you know, even smacks of cleaning up government. It passes with 75% backing. Is that your sense? Are voters ahead of the politicians here?
Certainly, if we look historically, both in Missouri and across the United States, it has often been initiatives that have driven major reforms. Common point would be term limits have almost always been driven by voter changes. Other ethics reforms, redistricting reforms in other states have often been created either by initiatives or by legislators looking down the line and seeing that initiatives are coming and making changes themselves.
You know, we'll talk about the redistricting controversy in a few minutes as we talk about Clean Missouri here. But let's go over some of the other provisions in this proposal here first. What about requiring that legislative records be open to the public? Jason, what is that about? How significant is it?
Besides the redistricting part, I would argue that is probably going to be one of the most significant aspects of this. For many years, it has been the position of both like the administrators of the House and Senate that individual legislative emails are not considered open records because legislators are not considered individual governmental bodies. This would put in the Constitution that that's not the case, and it would probably be up to the legislature to pass a subsequent law deciding what type of records are open or not. Because I think there is legitimate concern that, you know, very sensitive emails from constituents about, you know, very sensitive matters could then be sunshinable. And frankly, as a reporter, that's not really what I would ever be interested in looking for. But certainly if the law isn't written tightly enough, that could happen. So I do think that is legitimately significant. It's been a longstanding bit of tension between the press and the legislature. I do wonder, though, that if this passes, if both lawmakers and staff will stop using government email and then try to use different means. Like there was an article today in the Kansas City Star about how Josh Hawley never has sent an email himself, and Jay Nixon didn't send an email either as attorney general or as governor. And I would have just imagined that lawmakers may use other means to communicate rather than email after this. But I would hope that wouldn't be the case. And my hope would be if that passed, it would give more insight onto, you know, how lawmakers make important decisions.
You know, Deborah, there's this other requirement in Clean Missouri which calls for requiring that legislators wait 2 years before becoming lobbyists. I've had some folks explain to me that that's really a big deal. Why is it significant?
Well, I think in part it's because if we think about the short terms that Missouri legislators have, we have to ask, why are people taking the time to run? And one of the answers is that lobbyists have a strong influence on legislative outcomes, particularly in states that have short-term limits.
Mm-hmm.
So running for state legislature in a non-competitive district, you serve a few years and you develop the contacts that make it very easy for you to then influence political outcomes and decisions subsequently. So a 2-year ban could potentially disincentivize people who are on what we might call a lobbyist career pipeline.
Lots of concerns now, Deborah, that, hey, you know, if you're a lobbyist now, you want to encourage a lawmaker to vote a certain way. You dangle out the idea of, hey, a high-paid job as a lobbyist in the state capitol, that might induce somebody to do what you want them to do in order to get that job down the road.
Absolutely. And that's the kind of thing that's really hard to track, right? We can track donations. In fact, the Missouri Ethics Commission does a very good job of doing so. But if someone takes a job, it's hard to say if they got that simply for voting the way they were supposed to, or if the interest group thought that they did a good job in representing. And this is always actually the challenge with lobbyists in voting. How do you tell if someone voted because they were influenced by a lobbyist or if they were going to vote that way anyway?
Jason, and there's no question that lots of legislators, even today, do become lobbyists.
They do. And I think this would make it more difficult for them to register as lobbyists. I think we've seen federally, though, that waiting periods can be circumvented. Like, you know, legislators would become consultants that would advise certain clients on how to maneuver through government, but wouldn't actually like lobby legislators or the executive branch to do anything. Well, I'm not really sure if that would be stopped under Clean Missouri. And one of the other things that I think would be difficult to stop, too, is if you're an attorney legislator, I don't really see how any lobbyist revolving door would stop you from taking somebody that lobbied you as a legal client. Just because I think that there are probably some like legal and attorney client privilege sort of things that, you know, prevent the state from interfering in that type of thing. So it's probably not bulletproof per se. But I think most people agree that a 2-year wait is probably better than a 6-month wait. I think it's just going to remain to be seen about how that language is interpreted and how restrictive it ends up being. It also applies to staff, too. It's not just legislators. So if somebody worked for a state senator or a state house member, they too would have to wait under Clean Missouri.
What about, Deborah, eliminating almost all lobbyist gifts that now go to legislators? We're talking about sporting tickets, restaurant meals, all those kinds of things, liquor brought to them in the state capitol, beer brought to them in the capitol. How significant is this?
Missouri is, as I mentioned, one of the few states that doesn't have any restrictions on these types of gifts, although they do have to be reported. And there's a really high level of variation in how many legislators actually receive these gifts. Just this year, it ranges from zero gifts received to about $5,000 worth of gifts.
Wow.
And even if these gifts don't directly influence legislators, they're certainly getting their attention and, I think importantly, their time. It's much easier to get someone's ear if you're taking them to lunch at a casino than if you're meeting them in an office over cold government-created coffee.
You know, this idea, Jason Rosenbaum, of getting rid of lobbyist gifts to legislators from lobbyists, has been kicking around since, you know, at least back in the 1990s and maybe even before then. Why haven't lawmakers dealt with it before now?
I think some people don't see it as a problem. I think others obviously do see it as a corrupting influence. I think you've also seen that, again, going back to the socioeconomic levels of legislators, you often see people who are independently wealthy not take lobbyist gifts. You may also have lawmakers who, again, don't come from a wealthy background taking them for various reasons. I'm not saying that's always the case, but a lot of lawmakers that run for office and make a big deal about not taking lobbyist gifts often have lucrative jobs that don't require them to do that. But I would also add that lawmakers get a per diem, too. And even somebody who is not of well means can probably use that per diem to pay for their own meals. So I think that there has been a push recently to curtail lobbyist gifts, especially in the House. It's often been filibustered to death in the Senate. And there are various rationales people give. And a lot of them kind of go around to, you know, these lobbyist gifts don't influence my decision making. But, you know,
well, why can't the House or Senate just pass a rule, Jason, saying we're not going to allow lobbyist gifts in our chamber?
I I mean, they could, but they haven't. And I think lawmakers themselves could decide for themselves whether they take them or not. And some have, and some haven't. Right. But again, I think the reality is, because there hasn't been any movement on this, it's given the opportunity to the Clean Missouri proponents to place this into their multifaceted initiative and really focus on this part and make it appealing to voters. So some of the, you know, as we'll talk about in a bit, you know, make it more favorable for it to pass.
Right. We're talking about the Clean Missouri Initiative that'll be on ballots this November. We're visiting with Jason Rosenbaum. You just heard his voice. He's a reporter for KWMU Public Radio over in St. Louis. Deborah Leiter also joins me here in the studio. She's a UMKC assistant political science professor here. Finally, Deborah, before we go to redistricting, this proposal would also put a cap on campaign donations to legislative candidates. But I thought voters just put a cap on donations just a couple of years ago.
They certainly did, and the Clean Missouri Initiative would reduce it by a small amount. Mm-hmm. What I think this reflects is that the Clean Missouri plan has been a plan for some time, that this is probably multiple years in the making and was a part of the plan before Amendment 2 was passed in 2016.
People weren't betting that Amendment 2 would pass or even make its way to the ballot, perhaps. Okay. Well, let's go to the big kahuna here, Jason, and that's this plan for a big redo of how the state draws legislative districts. Why is this even an issue? Because we've got a plan that you've already described this morning as bipartisan, this commission made up of an equal number of Democrats and Republicans who are supposed to draw these lines. So why is this even an issue?
I think a lot of it stems back to what I said at the beginning. A lot of Democrats feel like the maps that came out after 2011, 2012 weren't fair to their party. There is also a nationwide movement among Democrats to make redistricting processes more favorable to Democrats, while ironically ignoring blatant gerrymandering in states like Illinois and Maryland, where Democrats are drawing the lines. And I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with that. Republicans were very aggressive about redistricting in the early part of the decade, too, which is probably why they got large amounts of majorities in the House and the Senate. This would not actually do away with those commissions, but it would create the position of a demographer. The demographer would basically the state auditor would solicit candidates for the demographer. In this case, since both auditor candidates are female, she would end up presenting a certain amount of candidates to the Republican and Democratic Senate leaders. They could potentially strike the demographer candidates that they don't like. If they can't agree on somebody, that would go to a lottery, and that's how the demographer would be chosen. The demographer would have to create districts based on certain criteria. If you read in the amendment, a lot of emphasis on partisan fairness and competitiveness. And there's also language in there that's aimed at protecting communities of color and minority representation, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a minute.
Right.
And I think that the goal, if you talk to the proponents, is to create districts that are more competitive. Because I think one of the issues that Missouri Democrats have right now is the Democratic populations are concentrated in, you know, Kansas City, St. Louis, Columbia, and some of the inner ring suburbs.
This is the issue here, right, Jason? Because this is exactly it, that Democrats are all packed into these very distinct parts of the state, whereas Republicans tend to be scattered throughout rural Missouri, all over the state. And the problem comes, how do you draw competitive seats when Democrats are packed in these very distinct areas?
I think that will be, I mean, I think that's the issue right there. And I think the I don't really know how what the map will look like after this passes. And there hasn't been really a sample map put out by the proponents, because to calculate the index that's in the constitutional amendment would require, you know, people to vote this year and in 2 years for president, governor, and the U.S. Senate. I think, though, what's stoking a lot of interest in St. Louis is the minority representation part. We have people who are very prominent African-American elected officials, including Congressman Lacey Clay, opposing Clean Missouri because they don't feel the language in there will end up preventing a scenario where very African-American legislative districts are still African-American after redistricting, but are hovering around 50% and could potentially be represented by a white person. Now, Clean Missouri proponents say that the language that's in Clean Missouri has been vetted by a number of civil rights organizations. It has endorsements from like the Missouri NAACP, but it is not. I would just say that this is a proposal that is not necessarily cutting on traditional partisan lines. There are Republicans like John Danforth, Rob Schaff, and Jim Lemke who support this, and there are Democrats like again Lacey Clay, State Senator Maria Chappelle Nadal, and others who are not supporting this, along with a lot of Republicans.
You know, Deborah Leiter, is it likely that if this proposal passes, Clean Missouri goes into law, that the new districts will wind up looking like skinny slivers that sort of jet out from the city into suburban and then rural areas? You'll have these long, slender districts that sort of jut out like wheels on a spoke from each of the two big cities.
It's certainly
like spokes on a wheel, I should have said. Yeah,
it's certainly possible, and it depends on how you read the instructions to the state demographer. Their first requirement is all districts have to have about the same size. That's a national requirement, and the second one, however, is the protection of the Voting Rights Act, which, by its design, is to protect minority populations from vote dilution. After that, however, these competitiveness characteristics kick in. And it is possible that we might see district shapes look different. It depends on how strictly interpreting or how strictly the demographer interprets these requirements.
They may not be so compact, which is one of the words that's often associated with redistricting.
That's certainly a possibility. And in fact, compactness is still one of the requirements for the demographer to consider, but it's subsequent to the two competitiveness measures.
Jason, are we likely to see legal challenges to Clean Missouri once these new districts get drawn and people begin to look at them and think these are either fine or they don't pass muster in one way or another?
I think it really depends on how the districts are drawn. If, for example, you do see scenarios where current African-American districts become less African-American, I think there may be a legal test about whether that, you know, runs afoul of the language in the constitutional amendment. Obviously, there are more blatant examples of that where you take a 70% African-American district and turn it into a 30% African-American district, which would almost certainly run afoul of that. But, you know, I think it really just depends on who the demographer is. I think if it's a demographer that is actually nonpartisan and it doesn't have like a political background, you may end up with a map that really doesn't provoke a huge amount of controversy. Even if there is a partisan person that ends up getting appointed, which is certainly possible, the Clean Missouri proponents say that the criteria in Clean Missouri is so strict and clear, so to speak, that it would prevent somebody from running afoul and being overtly partisan while drawing the lines. But it's pretty clear that the demographer will become quite powerful in this process. And even though the demographer could be overruled by the aforementioned redistricting commissions, I think it would require 7 out of 10 members for the House and Senate. So it would not be easy.
Right.
So this person that ends up getting selected would have a lot of power over how lines are drawn.
Deborah, just maybe a final point. Do you expect Clean Missouri to pass in November?
I suspect it will, although there has been a lot more recent interest in the No campaign, a lot more support on the No campaign than initially started. So it depends on whether people will vote, as they tend to vote, yes, on ethics reforms, or if the No campaign can be consolidated enough to sway voters.
Right. Okay, we'll leave it there. That was the voice of Deborah Leiter, a UMKC assistant professor of political science. We are also joined by Jason Rosenbaum. He's a reporter for KWMU Public Radio over in St. Louis. Thank you both very much. Sure appreciate it.
Thank you.
Time for a break. When we come back, our smart money experts will be here to talk about how young families can start themselves off on solid financial footing. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR.
And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Last week, congressional hopeful Charisse Davids joined us in studio. We discussed her close race with incumbent Kevin Yoder and her views on controversial policy issues. You can hear that conversation at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and author Doris Kearns Goodwin. She'll be back again. Her current book on leadership is seen as a culmination of her five-decade career studying presidents. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. While young families and couples face many unique and important financial decisions that wind up setting the course for long-term financial success. But here's the catch. Many young couples do not fully appreciate the impact these decisions can have far down the road. Now the smart money experts are in the house to examine some of the key issues that young couples face and the decisions they need to make to be financially stable and build that solid foundation for long-term success. The smart money experts today are Sandy Weaver. She's a CPA and a certified financial planner certificate with Petrovic Weaver Financial Services. Sandy, welcome back. Always
morning,
good to
Steve.
Have you. David Jackson's here. He's a certified financial planner, practitioner, and financial advisor for Waddell and Reed Financial Advisors. David, good to have you.
Hey, hi, Steve.
Jamie Bossy is a financial planner and life transition specialist at Aspire Wealth. Jamie, good morning to you.
Good morning, Steve.
And just a reminder to our listeners, this information is presented by our guests for informational purposes. Don't consider this to be a recommendation or advice. You ought to consult with a professional prior to making any big financial decisions. Well, let's talk about stuff in the news as we always do when you guys visit. The stock market, David, has pulled back. U.S. stocks, as measured by the S&P 500, have dropped 5.5% since the peak in mid-September. What's going on out there?
Well, a little bit of volatility is back in the mix,
yeah.
And a lot of it has to do with the rising interest rate environment kind of scares people. And then, plus, we've gone for a long time without any type of major correction, so a lot of people are looking for an excuse to bail out.
It's been a long time since we've had a correction here, isn't it, Sandy?
Yeah, it has. Since earlier in the year, we had a little bit of a setback. But, you know, trade tensions have heated up a little bit. We have some numbers. We have some implementations on that. So that scares things. Earnings are still coming in good from corporations. But, you know, people are focused on what's ahead. And those tariffs and issues are still out there.
So whenever things aren't dependable in the world, that's when stocks begin to get a little jittery, right?
Absolutely, yeah. You've got it.
Primary concerns driving the decline, we've mentioned the U.S. Federal Reserve tightening policy here, trade tensions, strengthening U.S. dollar, hurting U.S. exporters, international stocks. Anything else out there, David, that's doing all this?
Well, part of it is what I said. So a lot of people are just thinking, well, we haven't gone through any major corrections yet. And people are kind of skittish, thinking, okay, when should I bail out? Because this can't last forever.
Are some of your folks bailing out?
Very few so far, but a lot of them are asking when is the right time to get out.
Sandy, you seeing folks bail out?
No. Yeah, we're diversified. We have lower risk and higher risk.
Yeah.
Stocks and bonds, so yeah.
Okay. Well, let's move on to our main topic today, this idea of are there financial advantages, you know, for couples to be married or not, laying the long-term foundation for long-term success? Here's a question. Are there financial advantages for a couple who are married or are unmarried couples on equal footing these days when it comes to things like filing income tax forms? What do we know about that?
It's pretty equal.
Yeah, that's changed out there, though.
Right.
Yeah.
It's pretty equal now. There are still some advantages. You can argue in a way that the shift away from itemized deductions over to standard sort of favored singles more than marriage, because the standard deduction's pretty healthy now. So, you know, married people are most likely going to be using that standard deductions where if you're single, filing single, you know, that's you don't get that much of one. And if you've got a fairly healthy Schedule A itemized deductions, you know, you're still able to use that. So you could argue that part stayed with singles.
Jamie, let's turn to debt management and young couples, because debt's such a big deal for younger folks these days because of college loans, buying a car, buying a house, whatever it is. How do you talk to young folks about striking a balance between, you know, paying off debt and allocating resources to other goals? I mean, that can be pretty tricky stuff.
It is definitely a tricky conversation, Steve. Young families in particular have a lot of competing priorities because they're paying off student loans. They may be buying a house or thinking about buying a bigger house,
right.
Trying to balance paying for college educations versus paying for their own retirement and planning for those things accordingly.
David, how do you advise younger folks that when they come in and lay their woes upon you?
Well, yeah. You know, I did a seminar for some UMKC students at the dental college just recently, and the biggest topic they wanted to talk about was student loans and how to manage that student debt.
Yeah,
I mean, it's a really significant issue that they have to deal with, and in a lot of cases, I'll tell them, just think of your student loans as a tax. You know, it's a high tax, but it's a tax. And just deal with it until you're getting into a higher income bracket to where you can afford to make extra payments to try to pay it down.
How much interest are students paying on student loans these days? What are you seeing out there?
I don't have a current rate. Do you, Jamie?
Lately, I've seen a lot of 6 to 8% ranges.
So it's up there a little bit, and that adds up pretty quickly,
for sure.
The interest, yeah.
And in most cases, well, not most cases, but in often, you're not able to deduct that interest,
mm-hmm.
You know, so that makes it hard. So it's not cheap, you know, and it's unsecured debt. It's like 6 or 7%. So,
Students have any flexibility in terms of the plans they get into here?
They do have some, and we have referred some of our clients that have six-figure student debt to consultants who specialize just in that. But, you know, for the most part, since we're not going to be able to get a deduction out of it, we really want them to, you know, continue living as a student for a few more years and use that paycheck to aggressively pay down the student debt.
Six-figure student debt?
Oh,
are you kidding me?
Well, that's common.
Really?
Especially for grad students, right?
Yeah. For sure.
Yeah, but the result is instead of, you know, you want to buy a house, you can't be buying a house if you got a six-figure student debt hanging over your head. That's just amazing.
Exactly.
Yeah. How about credit cards? What do you advise the young people to do about credit cards, Jamie?
Getting a handle on debt is so important in the beginning when you're looking at financial planning for young couples, particularly with credit cards, because the rates are so high,
mm-hmm.
they can get out of control so quickly.
They should be paid off before even student debt sometimes because the rates are higher?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah.
Because the student loan is, you know, it's an investment in yourself, so it is a good debt to have, but, you know, the credit cards – with that 18% interest rate, 20% interest rate, they can just control you for many years to come.
How about big housing decisions, David Jackson, buying versus renting? You know, a lot of folks, older folks say, hey, buy a house as soon as you possibly can. Stop throwing your money away on rent. Is that always the right choice?
You know, I love that question, too, because the rule of thumb used to be, you know, buy a house
as soon
as you can, start building that equity.
Yeah.
We found out in 2008 and afterwards that even the housing market can suffer problems. And then when you tie yourself down with a house, especially when you're early in your career and it's that opportunity to relocate for greener pastures and you got this house you got to deal with now, it's not always the best idea.
So sometimes renting's actually a good idea, Jamie.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. If you're not ready for home ownership, the American dream can really become an American nightmare pretty quickly.
Wow. Sandy, you see the same thing?
Yes, yeah. You don't always want to buy a home. And actually, there are more millennials living with their parents than any other housing option right now. So they're not buying into the, we all need to go buy a house.
You've been peeking into my back door lately. There's some going on in the Kraske household here. How about budgeting and cash flow? You know, some say the secret to financial success is spend less than you make. That seems obvious. Jamie, how do you help young couples navigate budgeting?
Cash flow is a big problem for a lot of people. You know, it takes a lot to get that under control. But the key thing is that you really need to act your wage. So if you make $30,000 a year, you need to live like someone who makes $30,000 a year. You can't be buying expensive cars. You can't be buying mini mansion houses.
Mm-hmm.
You really have to live within those means.
Or even act, David, like you make $28,000 a year, right? So you can save a little bit.
That's exactly right. You know, we always tell our clients, pay yourself first and make that one of your primary budget items. You know, it's like, I'm going to save a little bit no matter how much it is that I'm making. I'm going to save a little bit of it. You know, if it's 10%, 15%, whatever you can afford, but start somewhere and make it automatic. So it's not at the end of the month after I paid all my bills, I'm going to save. No, as soon as I get that paycheck, I'm going to save, and then I'm going to live on the rest.
Boy, you say that so easily, but that's hard to do.
Well, that's why you have to automate it, because it is so hard to do. And if you wait till the end of the month, you're going to find other stuff to do with that money.
When you say automate it, you mean have it withdrawn automatically.
Yeah, whether it's a bank draft or from your paycheck. You know, just make it automated. So,
yeah.
And then you want to make it painless so that, you know, it's not like you're suffering from doing that, but just make it so you know it gets done.
David, it's never painless. It's never painless. Jamie, yeah, you wanted to hop in here.
Yeah. So a good rule of thumb on that is to balance out 80%, 20%. So 80% of your cash flow should be going to, you know, your housing, your bills, your necessities, and your lifestyle. And then 20% should be going towards your savings goals, whether that's debt payoff, retirement, education funds, but try to break it up that way.
How about some tech tools that are out there, Sandy? Mint.com, Quicken, what's YNAB? What is that?
That's for Apple. That's another budgeting app you can use on Apple. But Mint.com is great. Quicken has a phone app that you can use too, and then you can tie into it on your laptop or desktop. But they will all feed from your banking institutions right into Quicken or right into Mint.com, and you can see graphs where your money's going. You can set up budgets and map yourself against that if you want. Lots of times, just taking the time to know where your money is going can change your habits. You'll realize that you've been letting a lot fritter into places that you really don't care about that much. And then you can redirect those funds into places that do matter to you. So why have a $25 a week Starbucks habit if you're not that keen on coffee, and the office coffee will do just fine? But what you really want is some special vacation or something else, and redivert those dollars. And those kind of tools can really make it easy to isolate those.
Is that one of the first things you tell anyone who comes into your office? You know, do you have a budget? Are you living up to it? Can I see what you're doing? Is that just go without saying?
Yeah, especially when we're doing retirement projections or college projections, that's the starting basis.
Yeah.
And then we also do a back-end check. You know, you can tell us what you think you're spending, and then we'll tell you what we think you're spending. And then those two numbers better be pretty close, or we're going to run the stuff with our numbers.
We're talking this morning about financial planning for young couples and getting started early on all this. I'm joined by Sandy Weaver, David Jackson, and Jamie Bossy here in the studio. Let's talk about savings, David. Prioritization is key. 10 to 15% of your income being automatic, you've already made the point, is an easy way to do it. But then you look at there's need for retirement savings, an emergency fund. You know, man, it gets pretty heavy.
It gets overwhelming,
quickly.
Especially, you know, if you're living on a tight budget. The reason we talk about retirement, though, a couple of reasons. Number one is that so many people out there in the workforce do not have pensions. So if you don't save for your own retirement, there's not going to be anything out there for you. But number two is that most companies that are offering some type of a 401k plan, they have a matching piece to it that says you only get the match if you make contributions yourself. So that's basically free money that you could be leaving on the table. So I run into a lot of young folks who are thinking, well, I'm not going to get it into the retirement plan until I've paid off all my debt. I say, you're leaving free money on the table. How do you do that? You know, don't give away or, you know, give up on that free contribution.
You know, Jamie, this idea of an emergency fund, that's the one I think a lot of people overlook the most. One question always is, how much do I need in an emergency account?
Good question.
And how many
Steve.
Americans really have them to begin with? I just don't think there's that many that do.
I would agree. I think a lot of people are missing the boat on the emergency fund category. We target 3 to 6 months worth of your fixed expenses to have available in a liquid cash account at all times. A pro tip for that area is to put those funds in an online bank. If you're familiar with that, the you know, like Ally Banks, Capital One, 360, they offer a higher interest rate, and it's also out of sight, out of mind, because it's not in the bank that you use for your normal day-to-day expenditures.
Oh,
so you're less likely to tap into it.
Yeah. Then you have the whole need for saving for a major purchase, Sandy, whether it's a car, it's a house, and And then pretty soon you don't have any money left over for anything.
Well, and this is a lost concept, but, you know, say you want to buy a car. So what most folks do these days is go buy what you want, and then you have a loan and you pay off the loan. But in the old days, a generation or so ago, you actually knew your car was going to cost you 20 or 30 or 40, and you saved up a fund for that. And then when you had the money, you went and bought the asset. And financial planners like that idea. You know, avoid wasting interest expense. You know, so it's really important if you have short-term cash needs coming up over the next 2 or 3 years, you know, have some of that paycheck diverted into the goal specifically for that purchase.
Okay, let's go to some phone calls here. 816-235-2888 is our phone number. You can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Let's go to Grover from Independence. Grover, we're talking about young couples and saving for life's big adventure here. Good morning.
Okay, so I've started a 401k, and all of a sudden I've incurred a very large medical bill. The interest on the medical bill is exorbitant, and they don't want to do anything with it. Should I take a loan against the 401k because it's less than the medical bill, or should I just keep paying on the medical bill?
Okay. Sandy, what do you recommend?
Well, obviously, if your medical expenses, if they're charging you interest, which is, you know, somewhat unusual on a medical bill, but if they are and it's higher than the loan provision out of your 401k, then, well, you know, what you've said makes sense. But you also want to see if you can find your way into making sure you're able to pay that loan back into your 401k in the time
right.
that you're allowed.
I mean, they'll auto-deduct it. I'm making the payment to the... You know, to the anyway, it's 18% on the medical bill,
wow.
And it's 6% on the 401k plus the quarterly payment, and blah blah blah.
Yeah, that's smart thinking. So, I mean, yeah, that makes sense. But just make sure you can make that 401k whole. You know,
right? But yeah, that is good logic, though. I would agree with that. If you don't have a whole lot of other options, taking a loan against your 401k, at least you're paying yourself back, and it's pre-tax.
Yeah.
Okay. Grover, good luck to you. Thanks for calling. Yeah, you bet. There's also this notion of college education. A lot of folks don't realize, Jamie, that you can get a tax break by saving for your kids' college through these 529 plans. Tell us a little bit about those.
Yep, by investing in 529 plans, your money grows tax-free. So, you know, you're getting the benefit of all those years of tax-free growth by the time you use it for college funds.
So not a bad deal at all.
Right.
Okay, Sandy?
We are lucky here in Missouri and Kansas. I think those are only one of 9 states, I think it's the list, that let you get a state tax deduction regardless of which state's 529 you use. So if for some reason you hate Kansas's Learning Quest, you know, go to Virginia's.
But here's one thing I do tell clients, though, is that when you're trying to decide, am I saving for my retirement or am I saving for my kids' education, a lot of people want to put their kids in first, but like they tell you on the airplane, put on your own safety mask first before trying to help somebody else, because there are no student loans for retirement.
Right.
Yes.
Good point. How about starting a family, Sandy, and this notion of should one spouse stay at home? What are the key factors you advise a young family to think about there?
Well, the cost of daycare in the area is about $1,000 to $1,400 a month. So, you know, in one way you can view it that the salary of the lower salary of the two needs to be high enough to overcome the cost of that employment. But there are also some non-financial considerations to take into account here. One is you give up a lot in earning capacity if you step out of the workforce, you know, for 5 or 10 years. Jamie probably has, you know, a lot to add to this. But, you know, there is that too. So sometimes even if it's a break-even deal, you know, it really may make sense for both to stay in there. And it's also a values issue for couples. You know, how do they want their children raised? And so maybe you make some sacrifices on that front.
But if you're a single parent, Jamie, obviously that begins to change the game a little bit.
For sure. You know, as a single parent, a lot of times you have to work full time. It's often required.
Mm-hmm.
You need to get the benefits to have health insurance for your family. You know, finding childcare can be more of a trick, especially if you travel for work or those sort of things. You need to have flexible arrangements.
Okay. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. Tweet us at KCUR up to date. How about insurance, David? Health insurance, life insurance. What's the advice there?
Well, you know, particularly since we were talking about single parents, one of the most underutilized insurances out there is disability insurance. If you only have a one income family, you know, whether you're single or just one staying home and one's working, if that income stops due to some type of injury or illness, you know, how are you going to pay your bills? So disability insurance is really a key insurance to bridge that gap.
What about life insurance? Should young people even think about it?
Especially if they have children. Yeah. They should not only think about it, it should be a priority. I mean, I'm sure all of us as financial advisors can give you countless examples of people who die prematurely. And then what do you do to take care of the kids? Where's the money come from? Life insurance is the greatest tool out there to take care of your family if something happens to you prematurely.
Sandy, how much do you need?
Well, you can need a surprising amount. It's based on if there's two income earners, do they both earn about the same amount? Or if you have a high income earner and a low income earner and the high income earner dies, then that person needs a lot of insurance to carry the family, you know, budget the rest of the way. But on the other hand, term insurance is pretty cheap. Mm-hmm. You know, so, you know, that it's a good answer to those kind of needs.
Also the need, Jamie, to consider some basic estate planning, which should include things like what?
Wills are very important. So when you have children in your will, you name guardians for those children. If you don't do so, the courts are going to decide where they're going to live. And that could take some time. So they could be bouncing from home to home until the court decides where they're going to go.
Yeah. Okay. Again, our phone number here, 816-235-2888. How about, you know, the notion that you see that millennials are actually bringing down the divorce rate? I wasn't aware of that. What are we seeing out there
that
on that
front?
That was
surprising, too. I just saw that recently.
Yeah.
And, you know, all the statisticians had just assumed that the divorce rate was going to continue to climb. But what you're finding with millennials is that they're not jumping into marriage as quickly. A lot of the people that do decide to get married they're divorcing less because they're educated, and so they're more financially stable, and so the need for a divorce, you don't have that money conflict that's coming into play. So it really has driven down the divorce rate substantially.
And supposedly the decline is the steepest among college graduates.
Yeah, exactly.
They're living together. There are things happening out there in the world that's caused this rate to drop, Sandy. Like what?
Yeah, they lived cohabitation. They live together longer, more. Education is more important to them. They want to finish that up. They also are more worried about their student loan debt than getting married. And weddings cost a lot of money these days, especially if you have a destination marriage.
Yeah.
Weddings. So they probably don't want to add to it. But men are getting married at 29 and a half, and women are 27 and a half. So those are pretty.
Amazing.
That's a lot older than before.
Okay, we'll have to leave our conversation there with our smart money experts. I want to thank Sandy Weaver with Petrovic Weaver Financial Services, David Jackson with Waddell and Reed Financial Advisors, Jamie Bossy with Aspire Wealth. Thank you all for coming in today.
Great being with
you. Thanks, David.
Yeah,
too.
You bet. Last week, with Halloween almost here, our cinephiles talked about the spooky movie themes of vampires. You can hear that conversation and more at kcur.org/uptodate. You can find us and follow us on Twitter. We're at kcuruptodate. Follow me at Steve Kraske. Tomorrow, an epidemic that claims 116 lives a day from overdose. We take an inside look into the opioid crisis in America, and we'll hear one man's idea to fix it. Also, Doris Kearns Goodwin, the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian, will be with us. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Emily Reed. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.